entity. We broadcast on the unceded ancestral territory of the...
F90.1 FM broadcasting from Bern.
The following is a special CJSF presentation that interrupts regularly scheduled programming in this time slot.
I believe in living.
I believe in the spectrum of beta days and gamma people.
I believe in sunshine and windmills and waterfalls, tricycles and rocking chairs. And I believe that seeds grow into sprouts and sprouts grow into trees.
I believe in the magic of the hands and in the wisdom of the eyes.
I believe in rain and tears and in the blood of infinity. I believe in life.
I believe in life. And I have seen the death parade march through the torso of the earth.
Sculpting mud bodies in this path. I've seen the destruction of the daylight.
And seen bloodthirsty maggots prayed to and saluted. I have seen the kind become the blind.
And the blind become the bind.
In one easy lesson. I have walked on cut glass. I have eaten crow and blunder bread and breathed the stench of indifference.
I've been locked by the lawless. Handcuffed by the haters, gagged by the greedy. And if I know anything at all,
it's that a wall is just a wall and nothing more at all.
It can be broken down. I believe in living. I believe in birth.
I believe in the sweat of love and in the fire of truth. And I believe that a lost ship, steered by tired, seasick sailors,
can still be guided home to port.
This program is part two of Good Fences Make Good Neighbors, or Do They?, a series of programs about borders, walls, and fences, visible or invisible, that keep us in, keep us out, and keep us divided. Part two focuses on the evolution of borders within cultures, on the land, in our minds, and in our schools. This program is dedicated to any child trying to navigate a world of borders that don't make sense to them.
The Martians Claim Canada by Margaret Atwood. Okay, a country is an idea people get into their brains, says the mushroom. Without people, there aren't any countries. Mushrooms don't bother with countries. That's a start, says the second Martian. What sort of idea in their brains? You draw a line, you put up walls and gates and such. You say some people can't come in and other people can't go out. You say everything inside this country is a certain kind of thing, and that's how it is done inside the line you've drawn. You make laws, you have customs, and a language, or two languages, or 54 languages. It depends. Sometimes the countries have wars. That's when they cross each other's lines and gates and so forth and try to kill the people in the other country so they can get all of their stuff one way or another.
I'm Shelley Romelis, and I was for years a professor of anthropology at York University in Toronto, and my fields were health and illness, mainly, and music. Anthropology is the study of human cultures, the way people cope with their lives, make decisions about their lives, communicate with each other. It's a cross-cultural study. So that we try to avoid ethnocentrism, which means thinking that every culture thinks the way we do. It's the largest way of looking at the way other people and ourselves live in this world. It's one thing that we look at in anthropology is what creates these boundaries. People, as they started to own land, as they started to accumulate, they were more protective about their possessions. Whereas if you look at very early societies, there was a lot more cooperation for survival. And as soon as there was some kind of stratification involved, the wealthy or the people with most land or most possessions would find themselves in a ruling position. And then other people became more or less servants or peasants or people that produced for the ruling class. Well, sometimes I wonder if this was a romantic notion of early anthropologists, but with hunting and gathering cultures, you know, people that basically survived on subsistence, whether it was, you know, gathering fruits and vegetables or hunting animals that were available, there was more of a sharing philosophy. And the borders were created between those people and others who might be encroaching on their land. And I think one of the issues one of the evolutionary factors which created change in this way was the invention of agriculture. Because once you are spending time to grow your plants, you have an investment. And that investment means that you've got something to protect. It's this whole thing about ownership. You own something that needs to be protected. And then it increases in value. It means that other people covet it. Every society that I've studied has had within it whatever stratification happens within the society. For instance, some people within the society have more than other people in the society. Certain people are in privileged positions, whether they be potters or whether they be shamans, or they then have more power than other people in the society. So I think that there's an imaginary thing going on here that people say, oh, well, you know, there was a time in which everybody shared. I don't think that's the case. I think that even with the hunters and gatherers, I mean, there was a lot of violence in the society. There was competition over women. Competition over who was the best warrior. So I'm not talking about human nature here. I'm talking about human culture, which is a big difference. That culturally, people get very concerned about ownership. I don't believe in human nature. Anthropologists tend not to, because if you try to examine particular cultures, you'll find that even if behavior is similar, there's always a different reason for it. And competition, and the fact is cooperation also very much exists. I mean, when people find it in their best interest to be cooperative, they're cooperative. When they find it in their interest not to be cooperative, they're not. I mean, we can see it from the vantage point of today. And today, all these societies have been invaded by capitalism, etc. So we don't really know what these societies were like when they existed a long time ago. Everybody's been touched by missionary activity, so that you have the religious component, which has it in itself a competitive component, or some kind of riches and ownership, which is just, you know, part of the capitalism that goes on in the world. I do largely think it's because we live within a very capitalist society that is oriented towards money and profit, and there are very few people that can get out of that, that can release themselves from those kinds of values. And I would say, you know, because when I'm thinking about this whole business of walls, etc., you build walls when you're afraid of invasion. You build walls when you're afraid of somebody storming your property or taking what you feel you've worked hard on. Because if you're keeping people out, you're keeping people away from the stuff that you hold dear. Okay? So whether you're walling them out or whether you're walling them in, I don't think it makes a difference. In Toronto, which is a city we're very familiar with, there are all kinds of international communities. Okay? And there are communities of people that come and they never learn English. Are they coming and they're just basically, you know, coming maybe to the parents of people who live there. They never learn English. And they live in kind of a ghetto world. And I think that what happens is they get a tremendous amount of comfort from living in that ghetto world. You know, we know somebody who owns a Polish bakery. And everybody that comes into that store is Polish. And they all speak Polish. Even though they can speak English, but, you know, everybody's very happy to be able to go to a place where their comfort is, where their native language can be spoken. So there's a protection around that. That's a wall, but it's a very protective and maybe a kind of a positive walling in, because it's not harmful to anybody. It's not keeping people out. In other words, you can go shopping here even if you know English, they'll speak English to you. But there's a kind of comfort in knowing that there is a community of people that will be supporting you. So, I mean, this is a self-imposed wall to say we want people in our lives who think like we do. I mean, we could disagree about some stuff, but we want people with some very basic values who agree with us. So whether that's a kind of a setting up of a wall, it is. It is a setting up of a wall. But it's a setting up of a wall where comfort is, it's there for our comfort. It's not harming anybody. My summary statement is the more there is to lose, the more people will build those walls. And we have a very interesting situation now, a kind of a terrible situation, where, you know, we're living in a society where the stock market is plummeting, where the coronavirus is now one of the updated plagues, where the election is happening and people are kind of very nervous about this whole thing, what's going to happen. So you feel that this thing has taken over in terms of a great anxiety, which would be then making people want to even wall themselves in more. Wall themselves in and then wall others out. So it's a protective bubble, you know, where you feel, okay, you're safe, only safe hugging a friend that you really think could not be sick. Otherwise, bumping elbows or any way, you're distancing yourself, okay? From, you know, you're not going to the theater, you're not going to, you know, you're just basically, you're walling yourself in as a result of these kind of major anxieties. And I think you'd find that happening with any of these situations. And when we culturally reach those spaces that people are worried about something, you erect those walls in and out. People in, people from going out.
People are strange when you're a stranger. Faces look ugly when you're alone. Women seem wicked when you're unwanted. Streets are uneven when you're down, when you're strange. Faces come out of the rain when you're strange. No one remembers your name when you're strange, when you're strange, when you're strange.
My name is Zachary Reese. I am an assistant professor at the University of San Francisco. I am a social psychologist, which means that I study people in social situations. I'm particularly interested in romantic relationships, how they form, how they develop, how sometimes they end, And I right now am doing a lot of research on conversations and some of the rules that we set for ourselves during conversation that maybe we don't need to be setting for ourselves. I don't know if this is universal or if it's uniquely true of people in the United States, but I think people largely want to be perceived positively. And I think in most cultures, and especially in the United States culture, part of being perceived positively is being humble and honest and kind. And I think bragging is sort of antithetical to all of those things. So the real problem is people think that self-disclosing good news is bragging when other people do not perceive it that way. So I think that often culture will bring out or suppress personality traits. And I think that across most people and across most cultures, like I said, we want to be kind and honest and humble. So if your culture sort of invites that and rewards that, then you're going to be exceptionally kind and humble and generous. And if your culture cares a little bit less, then, you know, maybe you'll still value those things, but maybe a little less so. It'll come out in fewer situations. So we can be born with these traits, and then we can learn them through our socialization, through our interactions with culture, with teachers, with caretakers, things like that. And there's sort of a dynamic relationship between the two. Yeah, so your question is, like, why do people put up those walls, or, like, what are the consequences? I think that walls can be protective in a lot of ways. They help us protect our belongings, they help us protect our self-esteem, protect our relationships, things like that. And they can bring us a lot of comfort. And I think they are necessary in a lot of situations. I think that we often like these boundaries, these borders, because they tell us what parts of the world we are able to interact with sort of safely, right? And they do come with costs, though, right? Which is that we don't allow ourselves to fully engage with all of the possibilities, and they maybe prevent us from learning things about ourselves. I think it can be really comfortable for people to stay within the confines of the world that they have built for themselves. And I think that it can be jarring to leave those confines. And I also think that sometimes we don't want to know what we're going to learn if we end up leaving. So the classic example of this phenomenon is a student who doesn't study for a test on purpose because they're sort of afraid that if they were to give it a shot, you know, study their best, that maybe they wouldn't be good enough, and then they end up failing. So you can imagine, this is what we refer to as self-handicapping, and you might imagine something very similar with people not exploring new cultures, not interacting with different people. What if I learned that I would not succeed in my interactions with those people? What if I learned that I could not thrive in that culture? It's better to just not try, right? So I think this is one of the reasons why we like to stay within our boundaries. Mm-hmm. We know that fear is one of the greatest predictors of whether people are going to interact with people outside of their political party, and whether we are open to immigration and how much we travel, things like that. I'm always reluctant to speak in sweeping generalities. So whenever I talk, I'm talking probabilistically. You know, most of the people, most of the time, specifically in a U.S. context. And I would say people in the U.S. certainly have a negativity bias. So we tend to be particularly cautious. We try to avoid negatives in our environment, things that could potentially hurt us, threaten us. So I'd say we're a little bit more primed to be fearful than we are to be sort of embracing. I personally identify as gay. I'm openly gay. I'm married to a man. So I have a lot of sort of like personal connection to the topic for sure. So you're talking about the experience of sort of like applying this label to yourself and other people reacting sort of like poorly to that. I'm really interested in, maybe this is sort of like the opposite of your question, but what happens to the people themselves whenever they apply those labels to themselves? And whether they themselves experience those labels as limiting, right? I think that you can imagine coming out as gay can be really sort of liberating and exciting, and you feel like you are entering a new world, but at the same time, you are also now putting yourself in a box that is going to define how people are going to interact with you, potentially for a very long time. And so in a lot of ways, like this new boundary that you've drawn around your life, this new way that you've chosen to describe yourself, does come with risks and costs. So speaking from personal experience, you know, before I came out as gay, I used to think a ton about the way that I sat in a chair and the way that I spoke, how high my voice was versus how low my voice was. I used to think about my word choice. I mean, I used to think about what music I would tell people I listened to. And then the day that I came out as gay, I turned the volume up on my Beyonce, you know, like I was all in. And I think I have been ever since. And I walk around much more sort of unapologetically. So that's the plus side, right? Is like now that I have this label, I feel like I've removed other labels that were really limiting, you know, the like you're supposed to be a masculine, manly man label. That's just it's not a border that we draw around gay people. And so in some ways, like adopting this new label has been, you know, liberating of other labels. I think that sometimes when there are too many options for us to explore, we can feel a little overwhelmed. And so sometimes we like the idea that the universe has sort of like chosen for us how we are going to behave. So I think a lot of people navigate the world trying to limit the number of options they have because they know they will feel comfortable with whatever they have, whatever they move forward with. There are multiple individual differences that might predict whether people like boundaries versus prefer to sort of blur them, right? So like people vary widely in their tolerance for ambiguity. People who are highly tolerant of ambiguity would probably hate labels and boundaries and things like that. Or people who are less tolerant would, they really need them. They rely on them. I would say the same thing with, you know, openness to experience is another like personality trait. Another way of thinking about this is through attachment theory. Attachment theory stems from a lot of like child development work, looking at how children attach to their primary caregiver growing up, right? And the idea is that the ideal for a child is that you perceive your parent as a stable, secure base, your parent or your primary caregiver. You perceive them as a stable, secure base, and you can venture off from that base and explore, wander, play with new toys, go into new rooms. And you know that whenever you go back to that other room, they're still going to be there. And they will help you if you ended up falling and hurting yourself or whatever. Not all kids develop that way. Some kids will develop a fear that if they venture off and then they end up getting hurt and they go to look for help, that their caregiver is not going to be there anymore. So what do? They never leave the caregiver. They just hang out with them all day long. And they say, all right, I'll build Legos, but only if you're right next to me. And then there are other kids who develop by saying, I don't trust that you're going to be there whenever I need you. And because of that, I am not going to need you. I am going to be a lone wolf. I am going to go out there and explore, and I'm never going to attach. And it turns out that these styles, although they are malleable across the lifespan, they can be relatively stable across all of our relationships and the many ways that we interact with the world. So attachment is another sort of like predictor of how comfortable people would be with sort of exploring new spaces versus, you know, staying in their home base. We started this conversation talking about like whether these things are sort of inherent versus whether they are learned through culture. I should say that I'm a social psychologist, so I lean a little bit more on the learned side. And I think a really great example of this is the idea of cultural differences to begin with largely stems from the idea that, you know, some cultures just think and feel differently. They prefer different things. And the research doesn't totally support that. The research really suggests that what differs across cultures is the like systems of rewards and punishments for engaging in certain behaviors. I do think we are often afraid of those barriers being taken down because who knows what's going to happen to our safety and to our culture and to our identity. And I think that is something that occurs on all sides of the political spectrum. I mean, I can even imagine, for instance, a gay bar that has had bars up on the window and has been trying to stay relatively secluded and secret, and you have to know somebody in order to get in, right, and to find out about it. And maybe they get new management, and now it's open to the world, right? Like, that is the removal of a border. And that's going to be kind of scary, right? Because it could potentially change the culture of the bar, it could change who ends up coming in, what conversations are going to look like. And I think in some cases, people can be right to be sort of protective of their spaces, especially if they're spaces where they have developed a sense of like safety from oppression. Like, I do think there are some spaces that are worth protecting. I just think maybe we are a little over cautious. We protect more spaces than we need to.
Something there is that doesn't love a wall.
Something there is that doesn't love a wall, that sends the frozen groundswell under it and spills the upper boulders in the sun.
And makes gaps even two can pass abreast. The work of hunters is another thing.
I have come after them and made repair where they left not one stone on a stone.
But they would have the rabbit out of hiding to please the yelping dogs.
The gaps, I mean. No one has seen them made or heard them made.
But in spring mending time, we find them. I let my neighbor know beyond the hill. And on a day, we meet to walk the line and set the wall between us once again.
We keep the wall between us as we go, to each the boulders that have fallen to each. And some are loaves and some so nearly balls we have to use a spell to make them balance. Stay where you are until our backs are turned.
We wear our fingers rough with handling them. Oh, just another kind of outdoor game, one on a side. It comes to little more.
There, where it is, we do not need a wall. He is all pine, and I am apple orchard.
My apple trees will never get across and eat the cones under his pines, I tell him. He only says,
good fences make good neighbors. Spring is the mischief in me, and I wonder if I could put a notion in his head.
Why do they make good neighbors?
Isn't it where there are cows, but here there are no cows?
Before I built a wall, I'd ask to know what I was walling in or walling out, and to whom I was like to give offense.
Something there is that doesn't love a wall, that wants it down. I could say elves to him, but it's not elves exactly, and I'd rather he said it for himself.
I see him there bringing a stone grasped firmly by the top in each hand like an old stone savage armed. He moves in darkness, as it seems to me.
He moves in darkness, as it seems to me, not of woods only or the shade of trees. He will not go behind his father's saying, and he likes having thought of it so well, he says it again.
Good fences make good neighbors.
I mainly work in Tiburon, Mill Valley. And those are probably the wealthiest towns in Marin County. I mean, I'm sure there's, you know, many, many million-dollar plus homes in San Rafael and Larkspur and, you know, Cordillera and Novato and those places. But Tiburon and Mill Valley is probably the most kind of in-your-face rich. And there's definitely a different mentality between the two. In Tiburon, it seems like the people there are not, I think it's more conservative than Mill Valley. Mill Valley, I think, is more liberal than Tiburon. And I think the people in Tiburon are, I think it's an older group of people. I think there's a lot of probably Republicans and Trump supporters there. And they know they're rich. And, you know, they don't feel guilty for being rich. And they're not going to apologize for being rich. And they're not going to apologize for treating people like fish. You definitely see it when you drive there and you're in a pickup truck and, you know, you're wearing clothes that have dirt on them or, you know, concrete dust or drywall dust or paint or